Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome into the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I am your host for this first hour. Similar to some of the last weekend shows, we will be spending a lot of time on the precious metals and the precious metal stock sector simply because, man, oh man, that sector just continues to run. And right now, if you're in the right stocks, you can be making a lot of, well, nice paper gains, at least. That being said, there's still a lot to talk about in terms of general drivers of broad averages, markets, and even currencies, as we've seen the dollar go through a pretty significant breakdown just over the last couple weeks. I'm kicking off this weekend show with Peter Buchvar. He is the Chief Investment Officer over at Bleakley Advisory Group, also the editor of the Book Report website. I go there every day to keep up to date with what Peter is writing about in terms of data points and important news to follow along with. Peter, I want to start off just in a broad sense because you and I haven't chatted, I think, for about 3 months now. In your eyes, what are the most crucial either data points or news events that investors need to be paying attention to right now?
Well, right now it's all about where real interest rates are going and all the money that's flowing from central banks. That's really been the only thing that has mattered. The economic hasn't mattered, earnings. It's really just been following the flows, following huge spikes in money supply, continued meltdown in global interest rates, the rise in inflation expectations, which is leading to a fall in real rates, which is leading to obviously the rise in precious metals, but also leading to a rise in much everything.
So, Peter, let's break down some of those components that you consider the most important for investors to be looking at. We'll start with inflation expectations. These can impact everything from currencies. The U.S. dollar is moving down. Precious metals, those are moving higher. Bond market yields are moving even lower. Which, in your eyes, is being impacted the most right now by these increased inflation expectations?
Well, it's certainly leading to the rise in inflation expectations relative to conventional yields, definitely leading to a drop in real yields, which is leading to obviously a rise in the metals. The dollar continues to melt away against other currencies. I think a lot of that has to do with the Fed with their pedal to the metal relative to other central banks in terms of money supply growth, the exploding debt deficits in the U.S., with the U.S. budget deficit now at around 14% of GDP, all leading to that weakness. And while that's inflating pretty much everything, asset price-wise, I do think that if it were to continue, it's sniffing out a stagflationary type environment, in my opinion. That when I look at 10-year inflation break-evens in the U.S. at 160, and then I look at a conventional U.S. Treasury yield today at a hair above 50 basis points. And I look at the weakness in the dollar. I look at the price of gold. To me, this just has a stagflationary type environment written all over it, likely coming to a theater near you in 2021.
So I feel like we've been talking about stagflation for maybe not quite a decade, but at least 6 to 7 years because of the slow growth and easy money policies. Although in the last couple of years, we've seen a noticeable change of this easy money landing on other assets, not just in the U.S. equity markets. Clearly, some of that money is supporting the markets, but the run in metals, the run in some other assets is showing that investors are taking a slightly different strategy this time. Do you have any comments on that?
When you look at least what drives consumer price inflation, you have the good side, you have the services side. Over the last 10 years, we've had pretty persistent services inflation running at about 3% a year, year over year. But that was offset by goods prices that pretty much were either flat or fell. So the blended rate was always a modest inflation rate. I think right now, and also you had all the money printing that went on, a lot of that just ended up in reserves. I think this time around, we've had, with the pandemic, a major disruption in the supply chain. And that is majorly disrupted the supply of goods. And I think that when you've been able to, at least in the U.S., through all these massive transfer payments, keep a level of demand, or at least a savings rate, very high, relative to where it would have been ordinarily, considering where the unemployment rate is, that you have the potential that when there is a vaccine, hopefully the end of this year into next year, that when the economy does rebound, that the demand side for things could overwhelm the economy's ability to supply goods and services. So you may actually have a combination of higher services and goods prices that would lead to overall higher inflation. So that's how I see this being potentially different than what we've seen. And I think that this rise in inflation expectations, as I mentioned, is beginning to sniff this out.
Yeah, fair enough. And you know what? It still does all come down to this general economic restart and when we can all get back to what life was like before the pandemic hit. But that looks like it'll be very different back to normal. Now, in terms of central banks and money flows, no doubt all central banks and all governments are undertaking some pretty massive money printing. How do you compare the actions of all the different central banks? Because I've heard arguments that the Fed is doing much more than other central banks, but then other people are saying, well, all central banks are doing so much that it's even hard to play that comparison game.
Well, I mean, look at Japan versus the Fed. The Japanese, through yield curve control, has dramatically reduced the amount of QE, but the level of rates are obviously extraordinarily low. The Fed is doing extraordinary levels of QE, and this is still down from the even more extraordinary levels they were doing in April and May. So you look at different metrics of, okay, you can compare the balance sheets, and then you can also look at money supply growth. You can look at, obviously, the level of interest rates. But either way, we're just talking matters of degree. They're all going down the same path. The Fed is still just repeating every failed mistake of their own by just lowering rates to zero and doing QE, and what the Bank of Japan and the ECB have done. And we heard Loretta Mester, Fed president at the Cleveland yesterday, saying, yeah, we'll just do forward guidance. It's just the same old tired ideas that they keep just regurgitating and implementing and just expecting somehow a different outcome. When you had the BOJ governor, Kuroda, yesterday saying, we still have a 2% inflation target. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. If these people were executives of private companies and they had set a list of goals when they first came into office and then years later didn't reach those goals, they would have been fired. But because they're central bankers and government bureaucrats, they still hang around and still keep spitting out the same failed ideas.
Yeah, they do, unfortunately. But hey, it's a pretty consistent playbook that these central banks seem to work off of. What do you think is the main priority or the main priorities for central banks right now as we are trying to work our way out of the pandemic? Because I feel like this has become a little muddied here with all the news events and all the distractions everybody has.
Well, they're in their eyes, they're currently trying to buy time, quote unquote, buy time until you get to a vaccine. So no vaccine, no amount of money printing is going to get people to comfortably eat dinner in an indoor restaurant. No amount of vaccine is going to get somebody to go to a baseball game or a concert. I'm sorry, no amount of money printing is going to get people to do these things. So they keep trying to spur some sort of economic and consumer behavior in the face of an economy that's not going to respond to that. We had the Fed senior loan officer survey come out a couple of days ago, which is a quarter of the survey, which showed on the bank side, tightening standards everywhere. But on the borrowing side, outside of mortgages, which where housing has been a bright spot, you've seen decline in demand for consumer credit cards, for auto loans, for commercial industrial loans, and for commercial real estate loans. So you can bring a horse to water, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they will drink it. And the central banks, through ever lower interest rates, are trying to bring those horses to water, but that doesn't mean that people are going to binge on more borrowing.
Okay, I understand what you're saying there, but what happens if these central banks just stepped away from the markets, cut back their QE programs, actually started to raise rates? Wouldn't that cause a pretty devastating shock to the markets, or at least a very drastic pullback?
Well, that's the irony, is that maybe markets bottomed at the heart of the shutdown, and maybe markets top when we get a vaccine. Because when you get a vaccine, central banks can't rationalize zero rates and all this QE.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I see that outlook there, and I guess we're all just waiting for a vaccine. Can I get a couple comments, too, on this downward move in the U.S. dollar? I get that inflation expectations are playing a role into here, but we're seeing a lot of money flow into Europe. The reasons being maybe their economic restart is doing better, but I have trouble believing that Europe's going to come out of this no problem as well. What do you think is causing this massive shift to the negative side for the dollar?
Well, with Europe, they've definitely controlled the virus much better than we have. The virus spread is much more, the numbers are much lower than they are here. There's also a lot of hope, I think false hope, but hope that 750 billion euro spending package, that'll be a combination of loans and grants, will be a boost to European economies. Also, you have, I mean, look, you've thrown everything you possibly could at the euro since the ECB went negative in 2014, between ever deeper negative rates, troubled banking system as a result, a massive expansion of their balance sheet. Pretty much they've killed the bond market. And the euro always traded in this 105, 115 level. I think it's the rising debts and deficits of the U.S. compared to these other places that's now exploding exponentially, that is a major drag on the dollar versus the euro and other currencies.
Okay, yeah, I get that. That's a fair argument. And hey, in all fairness, we are starting to see some of these safer assets play a lot of catch-up in U.S. dollar terms, such as gold. Even now, silver's starting to make its move higher. What's your current view on the gold market, the silver market, and this pretty historic run that we are seeing, especially in gold?
I still remain very positive. I always viewed gold as money, and therefore comparing it to other forms of fiat money. And when you see, and again, I could have made the same argument 2 years ago, but it's only now that people are paying attention. But I think also because gold has a tight correlation to real yields, which continue to plummet as, again, inflation expectations rise and nominal interest rates fall. And then you compare that against the rising pot of negative interest rates, securities, where gold is a positive carry against a bond that yields nothing, or should say less than nothing. And then you throw in an economy that's trying to rebound globally, which is then helping the industrial demand for silver. And then silver obviously is dramatically lagged the price of gold, so we're seeing catch up there. And when you take a step back, you know, gold is only slightly above where it was 9 years ago, and silver is 50% below where it was 9 years ago. And you compare the fundamental backdrop today versus then. In 2011, the concept of negative interest rates was just a concept. It never existed outside in terms of a central bank moving to negative interest rates. It was always, you know, this theory that maybe one day, but never existed. Well, fast forward $15 trillion later of negative yielding securities. You look at the Fed's balance sheet back in 2011, it was about $3 trillion versus around $7 right now. And then you throw in the size of the balance sheets of other central banks. So you can argue that the backdrop for precious metals today is just so much greater in terms of its fundamental basis than it was the last time we had gold prices here and silver 50%. Or should say 100% higher than it is today, back then.
Yeah, still a huge disconnect between, well, the highs of silver and gold, yeah, just under a decade ago. But Peter, I think a lot of our longtime listeners have heard you on the show. They know that you have been watching the gold market closely. You have been encouraged for gold in a long-term sense. What have you noticed, though, among your peers? You work in around the New York area, and a lot of the gold bugs are now saying, well, who are the investors that are coming into this sector? Because, hey, there's a wide range of people that have shunned the precious metals for this decade. Who are you seeing as taking more notice of this move?
Well, any time an asset class jumps in price, people start to pay attention. And now that it's a record high, it's obviously gaining attention. I do think that when you look at the financial allocation to precious metals, it's still minute. And I think that there's still a lot of people that have missed this. And I think in the coming year plus, I think you'll see more institutional money, more individual money, more central bank money coming to this asset class. Again, when you look at what's happened to the value of fiat currencies, and if we actually do see a rise in consumer price inflation next year that I expect, it could give all these entities more reason to either add to their existing allocation or create a brand new one.
So, Peter, there's a lot of people debating what stage of a bull market this is for the precious metals, breaking it down in baseball terms of what inning we are in. If you see, it sounds like the picture, the fundamentals getting even better for precious metals into next year. What inning would you say we are in?
Well, when you look at gold, I have a target of 3,000 plus. So how quickly it gets there, I don't know. I don't know if it's in 6 months or it's going to take another year, but so gold has essentially doubled over the last 5 years after falling 50%. So I think it plays out over the next year or two. Silver still down 50%, as I mentioned, from its 2011 and 1980 peak. Well, is that still a bull market or is that just a dead cat bounce? I think it's a bull market, but that has obviously ways to go. And usually subsequent bull markets has that price either touch or exceed prior bull market levels. So that still has a ways to go.
All right. Well, Peter, final comments, and I'll get you on your way here. Deals with the election and the impact that you think it'll have on financial markets. It's starting to creep more and more into the headlines, but again, people are distracted by a lot of other, bit more pressing issues when it comes to their daily life and these still volatility within the market. How do you see this election causing havoc, or is it going to cause havoc in these markets?
Well, I think it depends. I think if Biden wins and the Democrats take the Senate, then the market will be immediately worried about higher taxes, both at the individual level, capital gains, which then reduces after-tax returns, and also the corporate side, where Biden has said he wants to raise the corporate income tax from 21 to 28%. If that were to happen, analysts would be cutting S&P 500 earnings by up to $20 to $30. And put a 20 multiple on that, that's 400 to 500 points in the S&P, just in a change in the corporate income tax rate, just on the math, putting aside the politics of it, or whether one thinks it's a good idea or not. Now, if the economy is still challenged, I'm not convinced that they're going to be so quick to be raising taxes. It'll be more just as a threat rather than something that gets implemented. And of course, if Trump wins, and Republicans keep the Senate, then things just stay as they are. And from a legislation economic standpoint, not much obviously is going to change. So there are a couple of nuances to, okay, one person wins versus the other person winning. But I think that the initial reaction to the possibility of higher corporate taxes and what that can mean for corporate earnings, the market would not would immediately react to the downside if Biden and the Democrats took the Senate. Just as they celebrate all throughout 2017, the prospect of a cut in the corporate income tax rate, which ended up happening at the end of 2017, early 2018, that led to an incredible market year and some of the lowest volatility readings we'd ever seen.
All right, Peter, we're going to wrap it there. It's great having you on this show. I find all your insights very thoughtful and insightful. And as I mentioned, I always check out your book report website every day because that's how I keep up to date on all the news, all the data, and your thoughts, which I find very pertinent and very timely. So, Peter, I really appreciate you joining us on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. I'll touch base with you in another couple months.
Thanks, Corey. I really appreciate being on. Always fun.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.
providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Peter Buchvar. I am chatting in this segment with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex, also writes the Mark to Market blog, which, hey, besides Peter's website, is, again, another site that I go to on a daily basis to break down key data points and key market moves. Mark, at the end of this week, we had some key market moves in terms of the U.S. dollar and gold. The U.S. dollar, which was really in a free fall, managed to reverse and move fairly significantly higher for a one-day move on Friday, and that's pushing gold down. Gold very much due for a correction. What's your takeaway from, I know it's just one day, but the end of the week action in the dollar and gold?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a macro type of guy, timing is not always my best suit. And so last week when we spoke, I thought the dollar was going to have a bounce. I thought it was going to take place before the U.S. jobs data. But we're really seeing it come after the jobs data. And the technical signals now, I think, are much, much stronger. Even though the euro and the Aussie made new highs, they were marginal new highs. They didn't stick. And so if I'd say that there's one general pattern that you see in the euro, you see in the dollar index, you see in sterling. Some people see it in the Aussie as well. Is it looks like a double top is in place. So the currencies made a high, backed off to like Monday or Tuesday's lows for the most part, and then back to the highs. Sterling, euro, and Aussie made new highs. But then they've come off more sharply today. And so what we've got to do is go through that this week's low, which is really the neckline. And that would just confirm that this near-term, sort of like long overdue correction. Remember, the euro was up 6 weeks in a row coming into this week that we just finished. And that is the longest streak in a decade. Same thing with sterling. And so I think that there's a lot of people like myself looking for, thinking that the move was getting exaggerated, even though in the big picture, I still am bearish the dollar. I think that we've got a serious tradable for some short-term nimble traders, but I think there's a pullback here in the foreign currencies that could bring us down a cent or two in the euro, for example. I was thinking that last week I was suggesting 116.50, and we stopped, of course, just below 117. But now I'm thinking there might even be potential to 115.50. So the idea is that in the dollar is looks like it's got some legs under it for the first time in about 2 months. And the other market that seemed very stretched was gold. And we're seeing that, like you say, for me, there's a key pattern here. And this is just a traditional chart pattern. And this is an instrument makes a new high for the move. And in this case, gold made a record high today, Friday, before the jobs data, and then has sold off and gone through the previous day's low. And it looks like, I mean, it's found its lows now as we talk late in the afternoon, and it looks like it will close those lows, and this is a key reversal, making new highs and then rejecting those and moving to close below the previous day's low. So where could gold go? We're trading, we got to 2075. Amazing, huh? We were just talking, it seems like just a few weeks ago, can we break through 1,800 and we shoot up to 2,000 and we overshoot that. And now I think that we're going to come back down and test, maybe it's 1950, something like that. Maybe we have to test the 2,000 psychological level, but I can see us pulling back further as this dollar correction story unfolds.
So, Mark, you mentioned there that this is a short-term type of reversal in both of these markets. What does that mean for time frame? How quickly could we see gold test that 1950 or the U.S. dollar take back a couple cents?
Yeah, I think that we could be seeing this in the next couple of weeks. I think that like the dynamic seems to be something like this, that the one of the big drags on the dollar has been the decline in U.S. interest rates. And the U.S. is getting ready, starting next week, it's going to be the quarterly refunding, where the U.S. is going to be raising something like $112 billion in coupons. Because here's really what happened. When we have all this, fiscal programs, emergency programs, they get funded initially by T-bills. And then the Federal Reserve, actually the Treasury, rolls these short-term bills into longer-term securities. And that's what they're doing now. They're basically going to be issuing a lot more bonds and notes. And so just in this next week's auction, $112 billion, this is about $16 billion more than they did in the previous 3 months. And over this quarter, that is over these next 3 months through October, the government is going to be raising about $132 billion more in coupons. So we've got more supply coming in at the long end. And so yields are, for all practical purposes, record lows, and the dollar is falling. So if you're going to try to sell this kind of debt, what do you need to happen? And you need to have interest rates begin to rise, and I think that's what we're seeing. The 10-year held 50 basis points. Our 2-year tested the record low just around 10 basis points. It's firmed up again. And the yield curve steepening slightly. I think it's going to begin steepening, I should say. And so I think that this will help give the dollar, build in a concession for the sales that the Treasury has to do, give the dollar this technical bounce that's, say, overdue. And I think that's the main push for the dollar coming. So the main fundamental shift is a higher interest rate. So it's going to take a little bit for the market to digest this. And so that's why I think while it's digesting this, I think this is when I think we have a couple weeks a correction or so for the dollar to the upside.
So, Mark, is there anything that you're going to be watching in the next week or two that could throw this correction or this reversal off course?
Yeah, so what would it take, I mean, to knock this down? Well, I think that, in the U.S., we've had Congress and the White House aren't talking anymore. Or they're talking, but they haven't reached an agreement about fiscal stimulus. And that puts more weight on the Federal Reserve to do more with monetary policy. So I'd say that's a wild card out there, what the U.S. is going to do with fiscal policy. When there seems to be almost three parties right now, the party in the White House, the party in Congress, and then the Democrats. So the big issue. Second issue that we've seen escalate this week is the new round of tensions with China. Not only did the U.S. send it like its highest official to Hong Kong in a couple of decades, send it to Taiwan. For the first time in a couple of decades, the highest-ranking official. But the U.S. has also moved to sanction TikTok, as well as WhatsApp. And so this is what was a trade war, closing, and then turned into closing down consulate offices. Now is becoming part of this internet story. And I think that tensions could still be rising with China. The thing to keep in mind there next week, towards the end of the week, U.S. and Chinese senior officials will discuss the phase one trade. And, of course, China is so far behind meeting its commitments that it could leave open to sort of heightened rhetoric around that review. And the other thing I just note is, ironically, the ink, the proverbial ink, on the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement. It's not even dry yet, and the U.S. is going to be putting 10% tariffs on Canada's raw aluminum coming to the U.S., and Canada has now indicated that they'll do a dollar-for-dollar, liquidations on a dollar-for-dollar basis. And so tensions do seem to be high, and I think that they'll probably get higher as we head into the U.S. electoral season, which is now within the 3-month window that a lot of traders use, those with a liquid part of, say, the options market, 3-month options and forward futures contracts. So it's becoming an investor's time frame now. I'm beginning to see volatility has sort of firmed up a bit against all the major currencies.
So then, Mark, when we look to, let's say, U.S. equity markets, how do you see a reversal in the dollar, more money being created, but potentially higher yields, all impacting the broad averages?
Yeah, today, as the week closes, the S&P is sort of straddling unchanged levels. It's got a 5-day rally coming into today. So it could be stretching into 6 days into the weekend. I still think that even if we back up 5 or 10 basis points in yield, I think most investors realize that fixed income is not the way to increase their wealth. And so I think that there's all kinds of problems with the stock market, the lack of breadth to it, for example. It's at highest levels now since the crash, and the U.S. economy seems to be moderating pace of recovery. But the S&P's gapped higher on Monday this week. And that gap is important technically because it's also a gap on the weekly bar charts. So I don't really see, at least in the way I look at the stock market, I don't really see, of course, there could be some profit taking and it's not up every day. I don't really see this thing reversing yet. I think there's still too many people who are on the sidelines who couldn't believe this kind of move is taking place when the U.S. economy is posting like record contraction. Yes, I'm just thinking that there's enough fuel left to continue this bull ride for a bit longer.
Okay. Well, Mark, I appreciate you taking some time on this weekend show. Again, everyone go visit Mark's website, marktomarket.com, and send me any questions that you might have for Mark regarding anything that we discussed here or any of the nuances, especially when it comes to currencies. Mark, thanks again for your time this weekend. I hope you have a great weekend. Everybody, stick around. I'm wrapping up this first hour with a company update from Orin Resources. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are getting an update from Orin Resources, traded on the TSX and the NYSE under the symbol AUG. I'm chatting with the executive chairman, Ivan Bebek. Now, Ivan, we're going to focus on this acquisition of East Main Resources. We've gotten a number of emails and questions and really just requests for an update to hear from your side of this acquisition. Now, there are some nuances within this acquisition of East Main. There's going to be a new company that will be formed, Fury Gold, which will be focused on the Canadian assets, which include Committee Bay and Homestake from Orin, and then also from East Main's asset Eau Claire and the Eleanor South joint venture in Quebec. Let's start off with this new company. This Fury Gold will be traded on the TSX and the NYSE, holding these Canadian assets. Give us a little bit more color on how this deal came together and the focus on these Canadian assets, please.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Corey. It's been a long time in the coming to split these companies, as I've said many times on your show. And you know, when we thought about this as a group, we wanted to do this intelligently, and to do it smart, you'd have to think about market timing, which I think we've got at a really good timing. You know, we've hit that one perfectly. I think the other part was, you know, in Peru as well, can we add more to each of these spincos as we spin them out? And we all know that Committee Bay and Homestake are seasonal assets. So for us, looking over at East Main, something we've looked at for some time, as many others have, we thought it would fit perfectly because you can drill it 12 months of the year. So it takes away the seasonality. It also gives a very strong base in value to protect the value of the company out the door. And it gets complemented by the really big blue sky that we have up at Committee Bay. So the balance of ounces in the ground, you know, we're looking at it as around 1 million ounces of 8 grams per ton. You know, the balance of those ounces plus the Homestake ounces where we just put a PEA on, and the opportunity to go find, you know, another Amaruq or Meliadine up north, we thought was a perfect platform or combination of assets to come together into this rising gold market that just started. And then the most important factor, and this also was something we thought about in spinning out, was bringing in more personnel, specifically a CEO that had experience and on two of the three jurisdictions that we were going to work in, being Committee Bay in Nunavut, as well as Quebec. And Michael Timmins, you know, by very, very big coincidence, happened to come available right at the same time that the merging of all these entities has come together. For those of you who don't know Michael Timmins, we met him during the Agnico Eagle purchase of Caden. were super impressed by him back then. Obviously, that was a great success for our shareholders, and you know, looked forward one day, had he ever become available, to working with him to do something bigger and something different. And if you listen to Mike talk, and we've done a lot of it this week with a lot of marketing for Fury, he joined Agnico when they had one mine, and he was there for the acquisition and putting of nine mines and putting them into production. So if you could look at a better company, I don't think you could find one that has delivered more value, you know, very share price minded the way Agnico has. And the fact that he's been there through the entire growth curve of that company is something we're going to leverage heavily off of in terms of his advice and leadership of how to take these forward. So that's Fury, how it came together. The ambitions are very clear. It's to build a major Canadian mining company. And that's a big statement, but we're starting on the right foot. And from that, you know, we're going to need a lot of currency. We're going to have to create a performing share price so that we can acquire more assets, be acquisitive, and also raise large amounts of capital to put these into production at various times in the coming years. And, you know, to drive that value, what we're going to do is we're going to start with a 50,000 meter drill program at the Eau Claire asset in East Main. And a lot of people view this as, you know, the lead asset, which it is by timing. But if we could drill East Main's Eau Claire asset, Committee Bay and Homestake, we would drill all three at the same time. There's no favoritism here. It's more about accessibility. And then there is a lot of low-hanging fruit we see from what our work that we've done on it to expand their existing resource. So I think that will be a massive launch for the share price in terms of a catalyst, 50,000 meters, as we get ready for a lot of news and the new targeting at Committee Bay and Homestake, which we'll drill the next summer. But ultimately, we probably see about 100,000 meters get drilled between, you know, provided the deal closes, November of this year and the end of next year across these three projects, and predominantly looking for more gold, which will be substantial.
So, Ivan, when I first saw this news release, I was encouraged for Orin shareholders because of the fact that I followed East Main for a number of years, and I heard nothing but good things about their projects from a lot of the geology-focused people that I really respect. But the problem was management had a heck of a time moving these projects forward, getting noticed by the bigger market or some of the larger investors. Now that you guys are taking this ship over and utilizing these assets, you mentioned that you see some low-hanging fruit in terms of growing the overall resource base at the Homestake projects. What does that look like? Can you give us a little bit more information on some of the targets that you're looking at, where you see opportunities?
Yeah, you know what, I'm going to save that for after the vote, because don't want to reveal too much before we get there, and the guys are still working out putting it together. But from a high level, you know, I think it's not unknown that there's a lot of high grade gold here that could be a lot more based on the limits of the drilling that's happened. You know, I think my favorite part about this asset is it's largely underexplored, and we clearly see the potential to find more than that's there already. And to speak high level from that, and we will come out with some very specific targeting that will come out as we go drilling, you know, post the transaction. So, you know, I think the previous management teams did an excellent job, obviously, making the discovery. But I think they, you know, they got victimized by the bear market. We've all seen that hurt a lot of juniors. There's been some proxy battles in the past. And I think there's been a little bit of a lack of focus and systematic approaches that could have done more with what's there. And, you know, I wouldn't fault anybody except for availability of people and approach to the asset. We have a very, very strict, systematic approach led by, you know, our technical team that really takes, you know, thorough approaches and does things in a very specific manner. And I think that's going to daylight a lot of value that's been missed or not followed up on. And so, you know, a great start by others. And I think we can elevate it considerably, as you've mentioned, and more details on that to come later this year.
So what about the comments that are going around the internet that you guys stole this asset? You did make the comment that, you know, East Main has been up for sale for a while, but address that comment that Orin moved in here and stole this.
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting perception, and every deal has, you know, feedback on them. When something was for sale and there's an interim CEO, there's no mystery there, you know, and people knew it was for sale for a couple of years, we bought it. We didn't steal it. You know, we came and we bid and we bought something that was for sale. And to clarify, we only bought 2/3 of it. You know, East Main shareholders get to continue on as a third shareholder in the new company. Plus, they get the upside of Committee Bay and to be part of a very capable, robust professional team that can not only drive their asset forward, but other ones in the portfolio. And, you know, something that I will say in terms of the perception that we stole it or got the better end of the deal, I mean, there's a huge premium. Their stock was trading at 10 cents, you know, when we approached them, or 11 cents. It's now at 30 cents. It's almost up 300%, you know, since we did the deal. I think that's a great premium. And it's a situation that, you know, we bought something that was available, that was for sale. And I think that's the way it should be taken by everybody. In terms of the ratios and the way we did the deal, it is unconventional. It was difficult when you have mixed assets in Orin to try and determine where the real value is on everything. And, you know, that's the whole reason why we're splitting the company, so that we can get valued for each of our opportunities individually versus all together and have this kind of challenge. I will say this, though, in terms of the East Main share price and the arbitrage, and a lot of questions come up about this. Why isn't it trading at the 41 cents you valued at it, the deal at? And I would say deal digestion has certainly been something of consequence. But by the time the deal closes, I think, you know, and we have to do a financing in conjunction with the deal, which is in process. I think once that financing is done, you're going to see a pretty big re-rate on their share price. I also think the gap will close considerably closer to the consummation of their completion of the deal. So for me, it's a no-brainer that this thing is going to re-rate. I think everyone recognizes, as you said earlier, that it's a really good asset and there's a lot of room to do a lot more with it. We most certainly plan to be very aggressive in doing a lot more with it. And I think, you know, coming out as Fury Gold, if you can think forward of what this is going to be going forward, think about the 50,000 meters, think about the aggressive ambition to grow at a really good pace in a $2,000 plus gold market. And I think then the equation is quite simple. And so for anyone listening to this interview, I think, you know, there's huge opportunity there to be part of something that's going to be worth a lot more, and that gap closes closer to closing.
Well, one other thing to consider, and I got a lot of questions on this, are the spin-out companies that will hold your Peruvian assets. Before we get into some of the nuances or questions that came in, just give us a little summary of how these spin-outs are working and the whole theory behind keeping them unlisted for the time being.
So, you know, in terms of this transaction, it's complex and there's a lot of layers relative to tax and structuring of how this gets done. The recommendation to us by our counsel and whatnot was to leave the Peruvian entities unlisted for a period of time and continue with this, which Fury, which will take over the Orin symbol. And so I'm not going to get into those really interesting details. I'm going to keep it high level. They won't be unlisted for a very long period of time. We are actually planning to file registration statements and also to continue to be reporting issuers. So once we determine to come back trading, it's a very seamless process. Does not take 6 months or something of the sort. You know, in the process of focusing, you know, there's a benefit of Peru being unlisted while we get drill permits and several other things that we're working on at both Sombrero and Curibaya. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. So we get to come out of the gate and really, really put a big shoulder behind Fury Gold Mines to make sure it launches and gets into the drill program with the momentum that we're looking to achieve while Peru gets to complete the drill permits. And so that's kind of a higher level rationale where what would be the point to be trading right away if there's no drill permits in hand, you know, on completion of the deal. And, you know, the second part of that equation was we want to add more, like we did with Canada, with East Main. We want to have a lot more value to talk about in both Sombrero Copper and Curibaya Silver, which will have a name change by the time Curibaya comes public. But Sombrero Copper will likely stay with Sombrero. And when I talk about more at Sombrero, we've been finding more targets during COVID. We've kind of been back at the drawing board. We've been getting a lot of leeway with a lot more access. You've all heard me talk about the community impact we've had that's been very positive. We got to be even more helpful during COVID when everything was shut down. We got to bring in supplies, not just food and stuff, but also medical supplies. So a reaction there and what people should expect is access to a lot more targets than the initial drill program we have suggested. We've also been creative to try and find ways to go and drill, you know, four or five of these massive targets versus the one we've talked about for some time. And, you know, there's a lot more that we haven't talked about in terms of new targets that are coming online that will all start to come out in the fall, late fall. And these ones will have, you know, some sampling that we've done. They'll have geophysics. There'll be a lot of work being done between now and then. So Sombrero is actually going to look a lot more appealing, you know, as we go. And the big milestone for us, obviously, is permits. We think the end by the end of this year is a very reasonable timeline. And so, you know, I think you're going into a January, February relisting kind of timeline. And I think that's relatively conservative, but it's relatively accurate of what we're planning at Sombrero. On Curibaya, you know, we have 2 square kilometers of some of the highest grade silver, you know, 2 to 18 kilo silver everywhere on these veins on surface. And, you know, we've been learning more about that since we kind of found that. And we just finished building our camp a few weeks ago. So exploration programs have started. The big reveal there will be the geophysics that they're doing right now underneath those veins or over top of those veins to show us what might be underneath them. Are they coalescing together? Is there a nice multi-kilo, you know, areas of targeting silver over decent widths, right? But in Michael Henriksen's mind and Dave Smithson's mind, our two lead geologists that, you know, drive everything to us forward technically, they wanted more for Curibaya on its own, just in case. It's a tough one to drill and deliver on. Spectacular start. We are very confident about it. And so they've been looking hard, and they're coming up with some amazing acquisitions that will go into Curibaya on the precious metal side, gold and silver targets. And so we're looking very, very forward to how Curibaya comes together. And again, same timeline. We think permits by year end. And then in Q1 next year, early Q1 would probably be the suggested listing time, January, February, around the same time as Sombrero. But both of those companies, you know, they got a valuation of about 46 million US, and a lot of people have argued with themselves on that valuation, including ourselves. But due to COVID and you know, not having permits and not having additional access to communities, I think it would be fair to say it was treated more as a holding entity, with the big unlock of value being permits. And then the additional unlock will be, you know, new assets that get added to Curibaya and the new targets that are going to come out that should be drillable in the first year of drilling.
All right, so Ivan, a couple key points here. One, the main one being that current shareholders of Orin Resources will get a share in both of the spin-out companies. One question, though, that I just want you to reiterate, because it came in a couple times, is that the shares are going to be listed when you start drilling. It sounds like this whole time frame is not going to be you guys drilling without the shares being tradable. That was a key point that people wanted clarification on.
Yeah, absolutely. And good comment about the structure. So in this transaction, Orin shareholders will get 0.7 Fury gold mines, and they will get one full share for Sombrero and one full share for Curibaya Silver. And to the question that you've asked about, will we drill while we're private? Absolutely not. You know, I think there's a lot of people that have learned about the Peruvian projects and are most certainly going to learn about them when we have a lot of advancements in terms of news of these milestones I spoke of by year end. And we would like at least a month or 3 to 4 weeks between when we come listing and when we turn the drill to give everyone a chance to reposition themselves so they could have a chance to buy shares before we go do the drilling, right? So you can rest assured it'll be at least a month of trading before we turn drills will be the target from us coming back.
Okay. You've been making a lot of other comments about other acquisitions. Should we expect to see some more significant acquisitions coming relatively soon?
I think on the Curibaya side, it would be option agreements, not acquiring other companies. And then in the Canadian side, you know, once we get the deal consummated, you know, when currency presents itself, if we have some success drilling and, you know, we start to see a very meaningful share price performance, we do have some other ideas in mind. And there's many, many things being brought to us as suggestions. But again, the aggressive ambition is to grow intelligently and things that fit our mold of what we're looking for. And, you know, by portfolio in Canada, all of the deposits, including, you know, the one at Committee Bay, they're all 8-gram deposits. You know, and we're looking at high profit margin, high profit, highly profitable ounces, you know, and not Committee Bay, but the other two low capexes, right? And that's going to give us a very good premium as we take these towards development. So if we can keep finding high-grade Canadian gold projects of consequence, like we have right now, and keep adding that, we think we build a fairly substantial re-rate in the valuation of that company going forward. and high grade is truly king, and Canadian focus. So that's what I'm referring to in some of the acquisitions on either end of Peru or Canada.
Okay. Ivan, wrap us up. What do you want investors taking away from this deal, the new company that is going to be called Fury Gold, and then also these SpinCos that current shareholders of Orin Resources will hold shares in all of these?
I would say, you know, first of all, what we've presented for shareholders, you know, and the ones who've waited and supported us for the last 4.5, 5 years at Orin, you know, we had a bigger vision to at one point do this as we found more assets that could be standalone. And so, you know, as a reward to being so supportive, the SpinCo at the eve of the bull market is the first step. This is early times on each of these companies because nothing's been drilled yet in Peru. And we are just about to start a new Canadian mining company that could become a major. You have until October 4th, call it the end of September, to get shares in all three by investing into Orin. You know, there's a very obvious arbitrage on the value of the East Main share price right now. And, you know, I think I want everybody to imagine, you know, the one problem we're facing is we don't know which is going to be the best performing entity out of all three. And to be able to say that is such a luxury when you're looking at the caliber of what we're doing in Canada, as well as Sombrero and what might come out of Curibaya. We're hoping that all three of these things can deliver that double-digit share price, you know, in a rising bull market with big discoveries and a lot of growth. And that's what we're going to work very hard to try and achieve. So thank you, everyone, for all your support, and look forward to the fun part. It's finally started, and pretty soon we'll be drilling in Canada and followed by drilling in Peru all of next year.
All right, Ivan, appreciate the update. Thank you for wrapping up this first hour. Again, everybody, keep on sending me your questions for Orin Resources or any of the other companies that I brought on through this week. But I appreciate all those emails that I get throughout the week. I also appreciate everybody joining us over the weekend, taking some time and listening to this weekend show. Keep on checking the website throughout the week. Ivan, thanks for your time this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you, you as well.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.